Prelude to Foundation by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1988 by Nightfall Incorporated. This book is read by Larry A. McKeever. This book consists of 94 chapters and is 434 pages long. The following material appears on the dust jacket of the book. Foundation, the beginning. Wisdom, wit, and an uncanny sense of wonder have become the trademarks of Grandmaster Isaac Asimov. Now, in an eagerly awaited publishing event, Asimov once again fashions the future of science fiction by going back to the beginning, presenting the overture to the greatest SF series of all time, Prelude to Foundation. It is the year 12,020 GE, and Emperor Cleon I sits uneasily on the imperial throne of Trantor. Here, in the great multi-domed capital of the Galactic Empire, 40 billion people have created a civilization of unimaginable technological and cultural complexity. Yet Cleon knows there are those who would see him fall, those whom he would destroy if only he could read the future. Harry Seldon has come to Trantor to deliver his paper on psychohistory, his remarkable theory of prediction. Little does the young outworld mathematician know that he has already sealed his fate and the fate of humanity. For Harry possesses the prophetic power that makes him the most wanted man in the Empire, the man who holds the key to the future, an apocalyptic power to be known forever after as the Foundation. About the author. Isaac Asimov is America's most prolific author, with more than 440 published books to his credit. His Foundation trilogy was given a special Hugo Award as Best All-Time Science Fiction Series, and Foundation's Edge won a Hugo for Best Science Fiction Novel of 1982. Dr. Asimov lived in New York City. The Dedication. To Jennifer Green Pencil Brell, the best and hardest working editor in the world. Author's Note. When I wrote Foundation, which appeared in the May 1942 issue of Astounding Science Fiction, I had no idea that I had begun a series of stories that would eventually grow into 6 volumes and a total of 650,000 words, so far. Nor did I have any idea that it would be unified with my series of short stories and novels involving robots, and my novels involving the Galactic Empire, for a grand total, so far, of 14 volumes and a total of about 1,450,000 words. You will see, if you study the publication dates of these books, that there was a 25-year hiatus between 1957 and 1982, during which I did not add to this series. This was not because I had stopped writing. Indeed, I wrote full speed throughout the quarter century, but I wrote other things. That I returned to the series in 1982 was not my own notion, but was the result of a combination of pressures from readers and publishers that eventually became overwhelming. In any case, the situation has become sufficiently complicated for me to feel that the readers might welcome a kind of guide to the series, since they were not written in the order in which, perhaps, they should be read. The 14 books, all published by Doubleday, offer a kind of history of the future, which is perhaps not completely consistent, since I did not plan consistency to begin with. The chronological order of the books in terms of future history, and not of publication date, is as follows. 1. The Complete Robot, 1982. This is a collection of 31 robot short stories published between 1940 and 1976 and includes every story in my earlier collection, I, Robot, 1950. Only one robot short story has been written since this collection appeared. That is Robot Dreams, which has not yet appeared in any Doubleday collection. 2. The Caves of Steel, 1954. This is the first of my robot novels. 3. The Naked Sun, 1957, the second robot novel. 4. The Robots of Dawn, 1983, the third robot novel. 5. Robots and Empire, 1985, the fourth robot novel. 6. The Currents of Space, 1952. This is the first of my Empire novels. 7. The Stars Like Dust, 1951, the second Empire novel. 8. Pebble in the Sky, 1950, the third Empire novel. 9. Prelude to Foundation, 1988. This is the first Foundation novel, although it is the latest written so far. 10. Foundation, 1951, the second Foundation novel. Actually, it is a collection of four stories, originally published between 1942 and 1944, plus an introductory section written for the book in 1949. 11. Foundation and Empire, 1952. The third Foundation novel, made up of two stories, originally published in 1945. 12. Second Foundation, 1953. The fourth Foundation novel, made up of two stories, originally published in 1948 and 1949. 13. Foundation's Edge, 1982. The fifth Foundation novel. And 14. Foundation and Earth, 1983. The sixth Foundation novel. Will I add additional books to the series? I might. There is room for a book between Robots and Empire, 5, and The Currents of Space, 6, and between Prelude to Foundation, 9, and Foundation, 10, and of course, between others as well. And then I can follow Foundation and Earth, 14, with additional volumes, as many as I like. Naturally, there's got to be some limit, for I don't expect to live forever. But I do intend to hang on as long as possible. Mathematician. Cleon I, the last galactic emperor of the Entun dynasty. He was born in the year 11,988 of the galactic era, the same year in which Harry Seldon was born. It is thought that Seldon's birthdate, which some consider doubtful, may have been adjusted to match that of Cleon, whom Seldon, soon after his arrival on Trantor, is supposed to have encountered. Having succeeded to the imperial throne in 12,010 at the age of 22, Cleon I's reign represented a curious interval of quiet in those troubled times. This is undoubtedly due to the skills of his chief of staff, Ato Demerzel, who so carefully obscured himself from public record that little is known about him. Cleon himself. Encyclopedia Galactica. All quotations from the Encyclopedia Galactica here reproduced are taken from the 116th edition, published 1020 FE, by the Encyclopedia Galactica Publishing Company, Terminus, with permission of the publishers.
1.
Suppressing a small yawn, Cleon said, "Demerzel, have you by any chance ever heard of a man named Harry Seldon?" Cleon had been emperor for just over 10 years, and there were times at state occasions when, dressed in the necessary robes and regalia, he could manage to look stately. He did so, for instance, in the holograph of himself that stood in the niche in the wall behind him. It was placed so that it clearly dominated the other niches, holding the holographs of several of his ancestors. The holograph was not a totally honest one, for though Cleon's hair was light brown in hologram and reality alike, it was a bit thicker in the holograph. There was a certain asymmetry to his real face, for the left side of his upper lip raised itself a bit higher than the right side, and this was, somehow, not evident in the holograph. And if he had stood up and placed himself beside the holograph, he would have been seen to be 2 centimeters under the 1.83 meter height that the image portrayed, and perhaps a bit stouter. Of course, the holograph was the official coronation portrait, and he had been younger then. He still looked young, and rather handsome, too, and when he was not in the pitiless grip of official ceremony, there was a kind of vague good nature about his face. Demerzel said, with the tone of respect that he carefully cultivated, "Harry Selden, it is an unfamiliar name to me, sire. Ought I to know of him?"
"The Minister of Science mentioned him to me last night. I thought you might."
Demerzel frowned slightly, but only very slightly, for one does not frown in the Imperial presence. "The Minister of Science, sire, should have spoken of this man to me as Chief of Staff. If you are to be bombarded from every side..." Cleon raised his hand, and Demerzel stopped at once.
"Please, Demerzel, one can't stand on formality at all times. When I passed the minister at last night's reception and exchanged a few words with him, he bubbled over. I could not refuse to listen, and I was glad I had, for it was interesting."
"In what way interesting, sire?"
"Well, these are not the old days when science and mathematics were all the rage. That sort of thing seems to have died down somehow, perhaps because all the discoveries have been made, don't you think? Apparently, however, interesting things can still happen. At least, I was told it was interesting."
"By the Minister of Science, sire?"
"Yes. He said that this Harry Selden had attended a convention of mathematicians held here on Trantor. They do this every 10 years for some reason. And he said that he had proved that one could foretell the future mathematically."
Demerzel permitted himself a small smile. "Either the Minister of Science, a man of little acumen, is mistaken, or the mathematician is. Surely the matter of foretelling the future is a children's dream of magic."
"Is it, Demerzel? People believe in such things."
"People believe in many things, sire."
"But they believe in such things. Therefore, it doesn't matter whether the forecast of the future is true or not. If a mathematician should predict a long and happy reign for me, a time of peace and prosperity for the empire, would that not be well?"
"It would be pleasant to hear, certainly. But what would it accomplish, sire?"
"But surely, if people believe this, they would act on that belief. Many a prophecy, by the mere force of its being believed, is transmuted to fact. These are self-fulfilling prophecies. Indeed, now that I think of it, it was you who once explained this to me."
Demerzel said, "I believe so, sire." His eyes were watching the Emperor carefully, as though to see how far he might go on his own. "Still, if that be so, one could have any person make the prophecy."
"Not all persons would be equally believed, Demerzel. A mathematician, however, who could back his prophecy with mathematical formulas and terminology, might be understood by no one, and yet believed by everyone."
Demerzel said, "As usual, sire, you make good sense. We live in troubled times, and it would be worthwhile to calm them in a way that would require neither money nor military effort. which in recent history have done little good and much harm.
Exactly, Demerzel, said the Emperor with excitement. Reel in this Harry Seldon. You tell me you have your strings stretching to every part of this turbulent world, even where my forces dare not go. Pull on one of those strings, then, and bring in this mathematician. Let me see him.
I will do so, sire, said Demerzel, who had already located Seldon, and who made a mental note to commend the Minister of Science for a job well done. 2.
Harry Seldon did not make an impressive appearance at this time. Like the Emperor Cleon I, he was 32 years old, but he was only 1.73 meters tall. His face was smooth and cheerful, his hair dark brown, almost black, and his clothing had the unmistakable touch of provinciality about it. To anyone in later times who knew of Harry Seldon only as a legendary demigod, it would seem almost sacrilegious for him not to have white hair, not to have an old lined face, a quiet smile radiating wisdom, not to be seated in a wheelchair. Even then, in advanced old age, his eyes had been cheerful, however. There was that. And his eyes were particularly cheerful now, for his paper had been given at the decennial convention. It had even aroused some interest in a distant sort of way, and old Osterfith had nodded his head at him and had said, "Ingenious young man, most ingenious." Which, coming from Osterfith, was satisfactory, most satisfactory. But now there was a new and quite unexpected development, and Seldon wasn't sure whether it should increase his cheer and intensify his satisfaction or not. He stared at the tall young man in uniform, the spaceship and sun neatly placed on the left side of his tunic. "Lieutenant Alban Willis," said the officer of the Emperor's Guard, before putting away his identification. "Will you come with me now, sir?" Willis was armed, of course. There were two other guardsmen waiting outside his door. Seldon knew he had no choice, for all the others' careful politeness. But there was no reason he could not seek information. He said, "To see the Emperor?" "To be brought to the palace, sir. That's the extent of my instructions."
"But why?"
"I was not told why, sir, and I have my strict instructions that you must come with me, one way or another."
"But this seems as though I'm being arrested. I have done nothing to warrant that."
"Say, rather, that it seems you are being given an escort of honor, if you delay me no further."
Seldon delayed no further. He pressed his lips together, as though to block off further questions, nodded his head, and stepped forward. Even if he was going to meet the Emperor and to receive imperial commendation, he found no joy in it. He was for the Empire, that is, for the worlds of humanity in peace and union, but he was not for the Emperor. The lieutenant walked ahead, the other two behind. Seldon smiled at those he passed and managed to look unconcerned. Outside the hotel, they climbed into an official ground car. Seldon ran his hand over the upholstery.
He had never been in anything so ornate.
They were in one of the wealthiest sections of Trantor. The dome was high enough here to give a sensation of being in the open, and one could swear, even one such as Harry Seldon, who had been born and brought up on an open world, that they were in sunlight. You could see no sun and no shadows, but the air was light and fragrant.
And then it passed, and the dome curved down, and the walls narrowed in. And soon they were moving along an enclosed tunnel, marked periodically with the spaceship and sun, and so clearly reserved, Selden thought, for official vehicles. A door opened, and the ground car sped through. When the door closed behind them, they were in the open. The true, the real open. There were 250 square kilometers of the only stretch of open land on Trentor, and on it stood the Imperial Palace. Selden would have liked a chance to wander through that open land, not because of the palace, but because it also contained the Galactic University, and, most intriguing of all, the Galactic Library. And yet, in passing from the enclosed world of Trentor into the open patch of wood and parkland, he had passed into a world in which clouds dimmed the sky, and a chill wind ruffled his shirt. He pressed the contact that closed the ground car's window. It was a dismal day outside.
3.
Selden was not at all sure he would meet the Emperor. At best, he would meet some official in the 4th or 5th echelon who would claim to speak for the Emperor. How many people ever did see the Emperor, in person rather than on holovision? How many people saw the real, tangible Emperor? An Emperor who never left the Imperial grounds that he, Selden, was now rolling over. The number was vanishingly small. 25 million inhabited worlds, each with its cargo of 1 billion human beings or more. And among all those quadrillions of human beings, how many had, or would ever, lay eyes on the living Emperor? 1,000? And did anyone care? The Emperor was no more than a symbol of empire, like the spaceship and sun, but far less pervasive, far less real. It was his soldiers and his officials crawling everywhere that now represented an empire that had become a dead weight upon its people, not the Emperor. So it was that when Selden was ushered into a moderately sized, lavishly furnished room, and found a young-looking man sitting on the edge of a table in a windowed alcove, 1 foot on the ground, and one swinging over the edge, he found himself wondering that any official should be looking at him in so blandly good-natured a way. He had already experienced the fact, over and over, that government officials, and particularly those in the Imperial service, looked grave at all times, as though bearing the weight of the entire galaxy on their shoulders. And it seemed the lower importance they were, the graver and more threatening their expression. This, then, might be an official so high in the scale, with the sun of power so bright upon him, that he felt no need of countering it with clouds of frowning. Selden wasn't sure how impressed he ought to be, but he felt that it would be best to remain silent and let the other speak first. The official said, "You are Harry Selden, I believe, the mathematician." Selden responded with a minimal, "Yes, sir," and waited again. The young man waved an arm. "It should be sire, but I hate ceremony. It's all I get, and I weary of it. We are alone, so I will pamper myself and eschew ceremony. Sit down, Professor." Halfway through the speech, Selden realized that he was speaking to the Emperor Cleon, first of that name, and he felt the wind go out of him. There was a faint resemblance, now that he looked, to the official holograph that appeared constantly in the news. But in that holograph, Cleon was always dressed imposingly, seemed taller, nobler, frozen-faced, And here he was, the original of the holograph. And somehow he appeared to be quite ordinary.
Selden did not budge. The Emperor frowned slightly, and with the habit of command present, even in the attempt to abolish it, at least temporarily, said peremptorily,
"I said, sit down, man. That chair, quickly."
Selden sat down, quite speechless. He could not even bring himself to say, "Yes, sire." Cleon smiled.
"That's better. Now we can talk like two fellow human beings, which, after all, is what we are once ceremony is removed. Eh, my man?"
Selden said cautiously, "If your Imperial Majesty is content to say so, then it is so."
"Oh, come, why are you so cautious? I want to talk to you on equal terms. It is my pleasure to do so. Humor me."
"Yes, sire."
"A simple yes, man. Is there no way I can reach you?"
Cleon stared at Selden, and Selden thought it was a lively and interested stare. Finally, the Emperor said,
"You don't look like a mathematician."
At last, Selden found himself able to smile. "I don't know what a mathematician is supposed to look like, your imp—" Cleon raised a cautioning hand, and Selden choked off the honorific. Cleon said,
"White-haired, I suppose. Bearded, perhaps. Old, certainly."
"Yet even mathematicians must be young to begin with."
"But they are then without reputation. By the time they obtrude themselves on the notice of the galaxy, they are as I have described."
"I am without reputation, I'm afraid."
"Yet you spoke at this convention they held here."
"A great many of us did. Some were younger than myself. Few of us were granted any attention whatever."
"Your talk apparently attracted the attention of some of my officials. I am given to understand that you believe it possible to predict the future."
Selden suddenly felt weary. It seemed as though this misinterpretation of his theory was constantly going to occur. Perhaps he should not have presented his paper. He said,
"Not quite, actually. What I have done is much more limited than that.
In many systems, the situation is such that under some conditions, chaotic events take place. That means that, given a particular starting point, it is impossible to predict outcomes. This is true even in some quite simple systems. But the more complex a system, the more likely it is to become chaotic. It has always been assumed that anything as complicated as human society would quickly become chaotic, and therefore unpredictable. What I have done, however, is to show that, in studying human society, it is possible to choose a starting point and to make appropriate assumptions that will suppress the chaos. That will make it possible to predict the future, not in full detail, of course, but in broad sweeps. Not with certainty, but with calculable probabilities." The Emperor, who had listened carefully, said,
"But doesn't that mean that you have shown how to predict the future?"
"Again, not quite. I have shown that it is theoretically possible, but no more. To do more, we would actually have to choose a correct starting point, make correct assumptions, and then find ways of carrying through calculations in a finite time. Nothing in my mathematical argument tells us how to do any of this. And even if we could do it all, we would at best only assess probabilities. That is not the same as predicting the future.
It is merely a guess at what is likely to happen. Every successful politician, businessman, or human being of any calling must make these estimates of the future and do it fairly well, or he or she would not be successful. They do it without mathematics. True, they do it by intuition. With the proper mathematics, anyone would be able to assess the probabilities. It wouldn't take the rare human being who is successful because of a remarkable intuitive sense.
True again, but I have merely shown that mathematical analysis is possible. I have not shown it to be practical.
How can something be possible yet not practical?
It is theoretically possible for me to visit each world of the galaxy and greet each person on each world. However, it would take far longer to do this than I have years to live. And even if I was immortal, the rate at which new human beings are being born is greater than the rate at which I could interview the old. And even more to the point, old human beings would die in great numbers before I could ever get to them.
And is this sort of thing true of your mathematics of the future?
Selden hesitated, then went on. It might be that the mathematics would take too long to work out, even if one had a computer the size of the universe working at hyperspatial velocities. By the time any answer had been received, enough years would have elapsed to alter the situation so grossly as to make the answer meaningless.
Why cannot the process be simplified?
Cleon asked sharply. Your Imperial Majesty. Selden felt the Emperor growing more formal as the answers grew less to his liking, and responded with greater formality of his own. Consider the manner in which scientists have dealt with subatomic particles. There are enormous numbers of these, each moving or vibrating in random and unpredictable manner. But this chaos turns out to have an underlying order, so that we can work out a quantum mechanics that answers all the questions we know how to ask. In studying society, we place human beings in the place of subatomic particles. But now there is the added factor of the human mind. Particles move mindlessly. Human beings do not. To take into account the various attitudes and impulses of mind adds so much complexity that there lacks time to take care of it all.
Could not mind, as well as mindless motion, have an underlying order?
Perhaps. My mathematical analysis implies that order must underlie everything, however disorderly it may appear to be. But it does not give any hint as to how this underlying order may be found. Consider. 25 million worlds, each with its overall characteristics and culture, each being significantly different from all the rest, each containing a billion or more human beings who each have an individual mind, and all the worlds interacting in innumerable ways and combinations. However theoretically possible a psychohistorical analysis may be, it is not likely that it can be done in any practical sense.
What do you mean, psychohistorical?
I refer to the theoretical assessment of probabilities concerning the future as psychohistory. The Emperor rose to his feet suddenly, strode to the other end of the room, turned, strode back, and stopped before the still-sitting Selden.
Stand up, he commanded.
Selden rose and looked up at the somewhat taller Emperor. He strove to keep his gaze steady.
Cleon finally said, This psychohistory of yours, if it could be made practical, it would be of great use, would it not?
Of enormous use, obviously. To know what the future holds, in even the most general and probabilistic way, would serve as a new and marvelous guide for our actions, one that humanity has never before had. But, of course... He paused. Well, said Cleon impatiently, well, it would seem that, except for a few decision-makers, the results of psychohistorical analysis would have to remain unknown to the public. Unknown? Exclaimed Cleon with surprise. It's clear. Let me try to explain. If a psychohistorical analysis is made, and the results are then given to the public, the various emotions and reactions of humanity would at once be distorted. The psychohistorical analysis, based on emotions and reactions that take place without knowledge of the future, become meaningless. Do you understand? The emperor's eyes brightened, and he laughed aloud. Wonderful! He clapped his hand on Selden's shoulder, and Selden staggered slightly under the blow. Don't you see, man? Said Cleon. Don't you see? There's your use. You don't need to predict the future. Just choose a future. A good future, a useful future, and make the kind of prediction that will alter human emotions and reactions in such a way that the future you predicted will be brought about. Better to make a good future than predict a bad one. Selden frowned. I see what you mean, sire, but that is equally impossible. Impossible? Well, at any rate, impractical. Don't you see? If you can't start with human emotions and reactions and predict the future they will bring about, you can't do the reverse either. You can't start with the future and predict the human emotions and reactions that will bring it about. Cleon looked frustrated. His lips tightened. And your paper, then? Is that what you call it, a paper? Of what use is it? It was merely a mathematical demonstration. It made a point of interest to mathematicians, but there was no thought in my mind of its being useful in any way. I find that disgusting, said Cleon angrily. Selden shrugged slightly. More than ever, he knew he should never have given the paper. What would become of him if the emperor took it into his head that he had been made to play the fool? And indeed, Cleon did not look as though he was very far from believing that. Nevertheless, he said, what if you were to make predictions of the future, mathematically justified or not? Predictions that government officials, human beings whose expertise it is to know what the public is likely to do, will judge to be the kind that will bring about useful reactions? Why would you need me to do that? The government officials could make those predictions themselves and spare the middleman. The government officials could not do so as effectively. Government officials do make statements of the sort now and then. They are not necessarily believed. Why would I be? You are a mathematician. You would have calculated the future, not
intuited it, if that is a word.
But I would not have done so. Who would know that? Cleon watched him out of narrowed eyes. There was a pause. Selden felt trapped. If given a direct order by the emperor, would it be safe to refuse? If he refused, he might be imprisoned or executed. Not without trial, of course, but it is only with great difficulty that a trial can be made to go against the wishes of a heavy-handed officialdom, particularly one under the command of the Emperor of the vast galactic empire. He said finally, "It wouldn't work."
"Why not?"
"If I were asked to predict vague generalities that could not possibly come to pass until long after this generation and perhaps the next were dead, we might get away with it. But on the other hand, the public would pay little attention. They would not care about a glowing eventuality a century or two in the future." "To attain results," Selden went on, "I would have to predict matters of sharper consequence, more immediate eventualities. Only to these would the public respond. Sooner or later, though, and probably sooner, one of the eventualities would not come to pass, and my usefulness would be ended at once. With that, your popularity might be gone, too. And worst of all, there would be no further support for the development of psychohistory, so that there would be no chance for any good to come of it if future improvements in mathematical insights help to make it move closer to the realm of practicality." Cleon threw himself into a chair and frowned at Selden.
"Is that all you mathematicians can do? Insist on impossibilities?"
Selden said with desperate softness, "It is you, sire, who insist on impossibilities." This book is continued at this point on the other side of